Good evening. Greetings and jumbo Harambe radio listeners. Asante Sana Madasi Abadaka for allowing us in your homes this evening. You're accustomed to hearing from Brother Baye Kemet on Monday evenings at this time, and my name is Mama Makini. He's asked me to come in his place and share some important and hopefully interesting information with you. But first, I'd like all of you to know that one of the reasons Baye is not with you this evening is because he's just welcomed a new addition to his family. So please send out your prayers and very good, pleasurable thoughts to this new member of his family, and that's what it's about, nation building. This show, getting back to the reason for this show, and hopefully future segments will focus on two areas of academia that are necessary for African people's resolution of our identity, collective understanding of our connectedness wherever we are located on the globe, and most importantly, intergenerational development. Again, my name is Mama Makini. I am a member of the Ankobia Society. I am a member of CIBI, the Council of Independent Black Institutions. I'm an educator and have been involved in African-centered education for well over 30 years. So that may help you understand why these areas are so important. Many of us have children who are not involved in African-centered education, but we hope that after this program, you'll get a sense of why it is so important for us to teach our own. The two areas I mentioned of being important are reading and history. We have all heard the statement that if you want to hide information from black people, whenever I hear black, you hear me say black, just put Africans in its place. If you want to hide information from us, put it in a book. We have also heard the adage, if you do not know where you are going, any road will take you there. Let's add to that, if you are not taught by your parents, you will be taught by the world. And the world as we know it today, and since we arrived on these shores in shackles, has not been our ally. But what we've got to focus on is respect for self, and that is the focus of this show. Of course, if we are to respect ourselves, we must have a clear view, perspective, and understanding of who we are as a people. And that perspective comes from knowing our story. I'm sure many of you recall hearing, but more importantly, recalling the vision of seeing families gather around the radio as young children. We were one of the fortunate black families, that is my family. We had the idiot box, but at that time we only had three channels. Remember, rabbit ears on top, huge tubes for the inner workings? But we had not yet given up the radio. And here we are using the radio again to ensure that our story is told. Such a warm feeling remembering what it was to sit in front of the radio. And yes, we listened to Amos and Andy, and we listened to other spooky stories, and it was so much fun using our own imagination. And that's what we want to focus on this evening, listening and using our imaginations to see the actions develop an interest and thirst for wanting to know more. Having our children listen helps them develop appropriate tone and inflection and assist them in their reading and speaking development. So gather around the radio. I know it's the computer. Oh, well. Encourage your family to join you. Read along if you have the book, and hopefully you are so interested you will want to know which book we'll read that we'll read from ahead of time and go and get a copy. Call friends, develop study groups, whatever you need to do to encourage reading and especially a clear understanding of our story. After all, we are the oldest people on the earth. Tonight's reading is taken from one of the clearest, well-read, down-to-earth master teachers I have ever had the pleasure of meeting, well, at least in my opinion, and that is Dr. John Henrik Clark, one of our esteemed ancestors. The book, and you know that Dr. Clark wrote many, this particular book is Christopher Columbus and the African Holocaust, Slavery and the Rise of European Capitalism. I really think this should be required reading for every high school student. But if the school does not require it, then it has to be one of those readings that we select for our children in our homes. Most schools just experience the Columbus so-called holiday. Remember, the word holiday comes from holy day. And we have to ask ourselves, what is so holy about remembering Christopher Columbus when we put holy in the realm of spirituality? And then Thanksgiving is upon us, and we're giving thanks for our families and for being here. So it is our hope that those educators who are listening and coming from different perspectives really listen carefully and really put on our thinking caps to see what is it that we can do to encourage people to put these holidays in a different perspective. It's already begun. It has begun for years. There's been a push to think differently about both Columbus Day and Thanksgiving. Recently, however, Edutopia, the magazine founded by the George Lucas Foundation, sponsored a poll asking, should Columbus Day become Native American Day? The majority of the respondents said yes, and indicated that Christopher Columbus caused irreparable harm to indigenous peoples. It is they and not him whom students should be taught to honor. So out of about 750 people, 37% said yes. Not an overwhelming majority, but nonetheless a majority. Now, had the question been posed differently to include should Columbus Day become Native American Day and African American Day, or Native and African American Day, my personal opinion is that the percentage would have been higher among the maybes or no's. Once again, incomplete information is considered and circulated and prevents people from taking an in-depth critical view of Columbus's voyage and the impact that his arrival on this side of the world had. But as is expected and as he committed and dedicated his life to, Dr. Clark gives us a much more honest look at the impacts of Columbus. Now, obviously, I'm not going to read the entire book, and I've selected two short parts, two and possibly three parts, to share with listeners this evening, beginning actually as a lead-in to part five entitled The Slave Trade, How and Why It Started. Coming from part four, is this comment. There is a need to examine the slave trade and slavery and the role of Christopher Columbus and his voyages in setting this great tragedy in motion. I am attempting to examine the slave trade and slavery with fresh insight and with a focus on long neglected aspects of this subject. Africans played a major role in opening up the New World for European settlement. Their labor and the raw material taken from their countries were important features in the development of the European Industrial Revolution. He continues into part five as follows. To understand African slave trade, we must understand slavery as an institution. An institution almost as old as human society. Every people, sometime or another, have been slaves. In fact, Europeans enslaved other Europeans for a much longer period than they enslaved Africans. Slavery was a permanent feature of the ancient world, in Egypt, Kush, and Rome. The African slave period is best known to us because it is the best documented. However, these documents are often confusing because they were created by people who were trying to justify the slave trade. Most people, especially Europeans, who created most of the documents on slave trade, write about the subject with the intent to make the victim of slavery feel guilty and to vindicate the perpetrators of the slave trade. Let me just make a comment here that so many of us who didn't have African-American history classes, or perhaps had those that were taught from not from our perspective, remember what it was like to sit in a class and hear the teacher talk about slaves, happy-go-lucky slaves, so happy to have been rescued from the dark continent and placed into slavery here under the master. And it, yes, it did make us feel guilty, and some of us held on to that feeling and tend to run away from who we are rather than embrace our identity and seek out this important and correctly presented information. Continuing with reading into part five, there is probably more dishonesty related to the interpretation of this subject than any other subject known to man. The African slave trade, like African history, is often written about but rarely understood. This misunderstanding probably grows out of the fact that we nearly always start the study of the African slave trade in the wrong place. The germ, the motive, the rationale for the African slave trade started in the minds of the Europeans in the 15th and the 16th centuries. The slave trade could not have started at all had there been no market for it. The slave trade started when the Europeans began to expand out into the broader world. The market was created by Europeans for European reasons. The story of the African slave trade is essentially the story of the consequences of the second rise of Europe. In the years between the passing of the Roman Empire in the 8th century and the partial unification of Europe through the framework of the Catholic Church in the 15th century, Europeans were engaged mainly in internal matters. With the opening of the New World and the expulsion of the Arabs and the Moors from Spain during the latter part of the 15th century, and we remember, of course, that the Moors were Africans who were Arabs and moved up north into Spain, north of Africa. Again, with the opening of the New World and the expulsion of the Arabs and the Moors from Spain during the latter part of the 15th century, the Europeans started to expand their homeland into the broader world. They were searching for new markets, new materials, new manpower, and new land to exploit. The African slave trade was created to accommodate this expansion. The basis for the European Industrial Revolution had already been established. They had already created embryo technology, including the gun. In the years that followed, they also used other advantages, mainly a large fleet of ships and rabble soldiers and sailors with no sentimental attachment to non-European people to take over most of the world. In so doing, they destroyed a large number of nations and civilizations that were older than any in Europe. The main problem with the African in dealing with the European during this early period was the African's tragic naivete. He had never dealt extensively with this kind of people. He came out of a society where nature was kind. Nature furnished him enough food, enough land, enough of the basic things he needed to live a pretty good life. These old African societies were governed by honor and obligation. Land could neither be bought or sold. There were no fights over the ownership of land. The land belonged to everyone. The European, coming from a society where nature was rather stingy and where he had to compete with his brother for his breakfast, his land, and his woman, had acquired a competitive nature that the African could not deal with. In order to justify the destruction of these African societies, a monster that still haunts our lives was created. This monster was racism. The slave trade and the colonial system that followed are the parents of this catastrophe. The Europeans, mainly the Portuguese, who came to the west coast of Africa in the 15th century, were not at first looking for slaves. The search for gold and other treasures lured them to Africa. They did not have to fight their way into the continent. They came as guests and were treated as guests. Then they grew strong, decided to be conquerors, and turned on their hosts. Another myth we have to dispel is that the Europeans came to Africa to spread civilization. Actually, most of the great civilizations in Africa declined after the coming of the Europeans. For years, the Europeans had been hearing rumors about African cities of gold and beautiful women. There were also legends circulated in Europe about a great emperor in Ethiopia called Prester John. But when the Portuguese arrived in Africa, Prester John had been dead for 300 years, and they looked for him on one side of Africa, and he had been on the other. But no European came to Africa to tame any raw savage. When the Europeans first saw the cities of Africa, they reported that these cities were well designed and that the African was civilized to the marrow of his bones. 50 years later, when they wanted to justify the slave trade, they started the myths about savage Africa with no organized societies, no cities, even no knowledge of the wheel. The European did not enter Africa to bring civilization. In fact, no nation ever invaded another nation for any reason other than to exploit that nation for its own reasons. This is true even when whites invade whites. It's true when browns invade browns. And it's also true when blacks invade blacks. The intent of every invader, no matter what his color, is to establish his own way of life, and in nearly every case, the local culture suffers. This happened when the Europeans invaded the west coast of Africa. We have their word that they did not meet an uncivilized people. We also have their word that they encountered not only well-organized societies, but societies that had a great deal of order and beauty. In 1434, a small fleet of Portuguese ships sailed down the coast of Africa and established some trading posts. By 1441, they were taking some of the tropical riches out of Africa and also a few slaves they bought who had been prisoners of war captured in some local skirmishes among Africans. By 1482, they had built the fortress of Elmina Castle, the beginning of forts built by Europeans along the coast of West Africa to protect themselves from the Africans when the slave trade was established. In fact, the slave trade did not really get underway until the Europeans had these fortresses built. And while building the forts with the help of Africans, they were telling the Africans that they had come to deal in honorable trade. And the naive Africans believed this story. These fortresses actually served as holding stations for the slaves that they were shipping to the New World. Incidentally, the Scandinavians entered the slave trade after the Portuguese, but they did not have any appreciable success, and they became middlemen in the slave trade. Then, when the Arabs and Moors were expelled from Spain, they returned to Africa after being the masters of the Mediterranean for 750 years. They had no sentimental attachment to Africa. They began to prey on the nations south of the Sahara, principally the old empire of Songhai. They first claimed the salt mines, for salt was then so precious that traders gave 2 parts of gold for 1 part of salt. They sent troops from what is now Morocco down into this area. The fight over the salt mines at Tigaza on the edge of the Sahara Desert became a great political and economic struggle. But something else happened, too. Christopher Columbus had, by sheer accident, started to look for the East Indies and instead found what was later called the West Indies. A new world was open to Europeans, and they promptly began their exploitation. That's the end of part 5. And it certainly is important for us to recognize the myths that have been perpetrated by European historians who came about later on in the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, who wanted to make it appear as though we were responsible for enslaving ourselves. There's little discussion about the different concepts of the different definitions attributed to that word slave and the process also known as slavery. We tend to want to hold on to the fact that, well, we enslaved ourselves. Africans enslaved each other. I think it's important to recognize, as Dr. Clark began part five, that almost every institution, that almost every society, every people at some time or another have been slaves or have enslaved their own kind or another group. But that was usually done in the process of war and as a response to war. Again, we are reading from a book written by one of Dr. John Henry Clark's books, Christopher Columbus and the African Holocaust, Slavery and the Rise of European Capitalism. Again, we selected this book to read at this time, having completed recognizing and some people celebrating Christopher Columbus Day or the Columbus Holiday, again, reminding that holiday is another way of saying a holy day. We have to begin to, at some point, look closely at what we consider to be an event to celebrate. Does that event celebrate us, or does it further hurt our understanding of who we are and our understanding of history? We're going to, at this time, take a short break and come right back to continue reading John Henry Clark's book on the African Holocaust and Christopher Columbus's role in the Holocaust.
Hotel, this is Junius Ricardo Stanton, reminding you that in the past 6 years of 24/7, 365 news and edutainment broadcasting, Harambe Radio has not had one official fundraising campaign. We have never asked you to stop what you're doing and send us a specified amount of money to help us continue our mission. We feel it's time to ask you to do your part to ensure the Harambe Radio and Television Network continues to function the way you expect us to. We have never sought any bank, corporate, or government funding. We've always depended on self to give you the best media possible. The Harambe Media family has always financially supported what we feel is the best station for us on the planet. Much love and thanks to all for that. Now it's your turn. This month, we want every Harambe listener to donate $20 for the year to help bring you the programming you've come to expect from Harambe. That's right, just $20 for an entire year of great programming. For doing the right thing, we'll give each contributor an MP3 file of any Harambe program done during the past 6 months. That's right, as a token of our appreciation, you get your choice of any of the great programs done here during the past 6 months. Click on the donate link on the Harambe website, www.haramberadio.com/donate, and donate $20 or more. Please do your part to keep us functioning. There have been many great guests and information over the past 6 years. We are asking you to donate $20 a day to keep us going and growing. Mail your check or money order to Harambe Radio, 4445 Mecum, M-E-C-U-M, Road, Walkertown, Walkertown, North Carolina, 27051. Asante Sana from the Harambe family.
Greetings.
This is Delani Amon thanking you for listening to Harambe Radio. Harambe, Harambe, Harambe.
Working together for progress.
Feel the oneness of Harambe.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Hi, good evening, Jumbo. Back again with my woman Keating, reading from Dr. John Henry Clark's clear and so in such an informative book called The African Holocaust, Slavery and the Rise of European Capitalism. Again, thanks so much to Brother Baye Kemet for allowing me to come into your homes this evening. Again, he is in recovery. And a little tired because he welcomed a new member of his family. So we say congratulations to the Kemets for their new arrival. We've been reading from part 5 of the book, Dr. Clark's book. We're getting ready to move into part 6, but before we do that, I'm going to go back just a little bit and share a bit of information that helps us lead into part 6 and some of part 7. Let me point out that Dr. Clark researches very, very well the information that he includes in his books. He uses material from all authors, as mentioned in the previous period. He talks about making certain to use words from the historians of the time. We're talking about Europeans researching and using their own words about their times and the activities that they were involved in. Dr. Clark calls attention to Michael Bradley's work, The Iceman Inheritance, that deals very frankly with the rise and expansion of European racism, and the book by Francis Cress Welsing, The ISIS Papers, that deals more specifically with the origins of white racism and how it affects African people. There weren't enough soldiers in Europe to take over the continent of Africa, India, the Caribbean islands, and then both South and North America. And this is an extremely important point that Dr. Clark continues to make, as well as the four myths. The greatest achievement of the Europeans, he says, was the conquest of the mind of their victims through a series of myths that could bear reexamining in order to understand the deeper meaning of the Christopher Columbus era and its reverberations for today. One, the first myth, the myth of a people waiting in darkness for another people to bring them the light. In most countries where the Europeans invaded or influenced, doubt the light of local civilizations and culture and destroyed civilizations that were old before Europeans were born. The second, the myth of a people without a legitimate God. Europeans made no serious attempt to understand the religious cultures of non-European people wherever they went in the world. If their God concept was not in agreement with the Europeans, then the Europeans assumed that they had no God worthy of worship. The third, the myth of the primitive and the aborigine. Here we have a misinterpretation of two words that originally meant first or the original. European interpretation was derogatory and downgrading, and it still is. In many ways, the Europeans were saying to non-European people that they did not have the right to choose a God or a culture different from that of the Europeans. Did not have the right to choose. That's important also to hear in this particular myth. Fourth, the myth of the invader and conqueror as civilizer. And we spoke about that in part 5, that most peoples who are invading and conquering another people are not attempting to civilize, but simply to conquer. Generally speaking, Dr. Clark says, no people ever spread any civilization anywhere or at any time in human history through invasion and conquest. The invader and the conqueror spreads his way of life at the expense of his victim. They generally destroy civilization in the name of civilization. In this initial expansion, the Europeans not only colonized history, they colonized information about history. The most disastrous of all their colonizations was the colonization of the image of God. They denied the conquered people the right to see God through their own imagination or to address God in a word that came from their own language. We've seen that depicted in movies that have captured or attempting to capture our history. We've seen that depicted in the destruction of our names, in destroying our spirit so that we would not use our names. We've seen that depicted in Ken by our imagination and by our re-identification and revitalization efforts, know the importance of having a name that represents you and means something from our own traditions and our own experiences. We're going to continue now with part six, Time of Troubles. Africa's time of tragedy and decline started both in Europe and in Africa itself. For more than 1,000 years, Africans had been bringing into being empire after empire. But the opening of Europe's era of exploration, Africa's own internal strife, and the slave trade, turned what had been Africa's golden age into a time of troubles. The Crusades may be called the beginning of Europe's reawakening, a religious fervor, not unrelated to politics, had stirred Europeans out of their lethargy and their indifference to the larger world. The first crusade, begun in 1095, was precipitated by the Seljuk Turks, whose persecution of Christians had placed even Constantinople in jeopardy. The eastern heads of the church appealed to Pope Urban II for help. At a great church council in France, the Pope pointed out that if Constantinople fell to the Turks, Western Europe would soon be overrun. He made an eloquent plea to the kings and princes gathered and to all Western European Christendom to rally to the aid of the Christians in the East and to drive the, quote, infidels from the Holy Land. This religious crisis gave Europe a semblance of unity. And although it can be said that the Crusades were military and religious failures, they did not provide the opportunity to bring new information to, they did provide the opportunity to bring new information to Europe. The religious wars also had a profound effect on the political development of Europe. The Western monarchs were able to strengthen their authority and develop a strong central government, while many members of their turbulent aristocracies were fighting in the Holy Land. Contact with the East had a deep and lasting effect on the Crusaders, who belonged to a civilization where culture and learning had almost vanished during the Dark Ages. The princes in their castles and the peasants in their huts were equally ignorant and uneducated. When they arrived in the East, they soon realized how backward were the people of the West. They marveled at the beautiful cities, the thriving commerce, the busy industries, the art, and the learning. The impetus for exploration was fueled by what the Crusaders met along the way. Ships built to ferry the Crusaders to the Holy Land returned, laden with the products of the East. The cargoes of spices, fruits, rich silks, satins, velvets, and other luxury goods had found a ready market. Thus, the Crusades brought into being the first attempts to open fresh trade routes to the East. Early in the 15th century, Europeans, in search of new worlds to conquer and of a food supply to feed the continent's hungry population, began to venture across the seas. North Africa. By 1492, North Africa was confronted with the painful fact of its waning influence in Mediterranean Europe. Spain and Portugal, which had broken the yoke of North African domination, were asserting themselves as powerful, independent nations with colonial aspirations in the lands of their former conquerors. That's important for us to realize. We often, in our classrooms, don't talk much about who the Moors were and the fact that how long the Moors ruled over Mediterranean Europe in Spain and in Portugal. And so it would almost stand to reason that once those conquerors were pushed out of the country, once they were overturned, now there is an effort for the former conquered to become the conquerors. Islam, a great religious and military force in North Africa and the Middle East since the latter part of the 7th century, was torn apart by internal strife and bickering. The relationship of North Africa to the people of the Western Sudan was deteriorating. For hundreds of years, this relationship had been good. Africans from the Western Sudan had participated in large numbers in the conquest of Spain in the year AD 711. These Africans made up the major military force that kept Spain under North African domination, and they participated in that country's intellectual life, as is still reflected in Spain's art, culture, and literature. And for you young folks who are listening, it is so important. While it is important for us to travel to Africa and to the islands and to other parts of the world where we are, it is extremely important for us to go to Europe and to seek out documents, to seek out artifacts that also help to tell the story and can continue to tell the story that Dr. Clark and other renowned historians began telling. So many of the references that Dr. Clark used were of European historians, European scholars, and so we must go with the intent of uncovering information that perhaps our elders, who are now our ancestors, were unable to uncover. In order to understand this neglected aspect of history, the role of Africans in the conquering and ruling of Spain, it is necessary to go back in time to retell, at least briefly, the part that black Africans played in the rise of Islam and in the spread of Islamic influence to Mediterranean Europe. After consolidating their position in Spain, the Muslims began to establish institutions of research and learning whose brilliance was felt far beyond Spain's borders. This was an achievement not of the Arabs alone. It was brought into being by a combination of Africans and Arabs, collectively referred to by Europeans as Moors. The word Moor entered the vocabulary of the Europeans, meaning blacks, as in blackamoor. By the end of the 14th century, Southern Europe had gained enough strength, military and otherwise, to challenge their African and Arab masters. By the end of the 15th century, the Arabs and Moors had lost all Spain except the Kingdom of Granada. The Christians, although they also had their internal disputes, were finally united. The marriage of Ferdinand and Isabella joined the formerly hostile royal houses of Aragon and Castile, and together their forces blockaded the city of Granada. After 8 months, the Moorish governor finally surrendered. This marked the end of an era. Europe had literally been reborn. The Africans who had planted the seeds of progress in southern Europe had not made the best use of the harvest that followed. The progress and excitement that had inspired Europe during the 15th century and had carried medieval Europe over into the modern world had brought no progressive changes to North Africa, now rocked with conflict. In the countries of North Africa, especially in Morocco, political stagnation seemed to be the general rule, and strong men with selfish intent found their opportunity to seize power. They no longer protected the poets and scholars. They left no monuments to embellish the conquered cities. To North Africans, the 15th century was a time in which Spain was a lost and hated land, a century in which Portugal robbed North Africa of a large part of its western seacoast. The news in 1492 of Christopher Columbus's discovery of the New World came swiftly to the courts of Fez, Marrakesh, and Cairo, and was no cause for rejoicing. That is the end of part six, and as mentioned, we are going to move into some part of part seven, and hope that we will whet your whistle, as the saying goes, that we will encourage you to continue reading, to continue, if you have not read this book, to pick it up and read it during this time, and share it with your children, whether they are grown or not. And let me just say that a part of why we wanted to share this information with you comes from a personal experience of reading to my grown children as we are traveling and riding long distances, and we found that it's such a great way to share information and to have discussion. So we certainly hope that some of the listeners will try this way of sharing information. Going into part seven, Sorrow in a New Land. When in 1492 Columbus, representing the Spanish monarchy, discovered the New World, he set in train the long and bitter international rivalry over colonial possessions, for which, after 4.5 centuries, no solution has yet been found. Portugal, which had initiated the movement of international expansion, claimed the new territories on the grounds that they fell within the scope of a papal bull of 1455, authorizing her to reduce to servitude all infidel peoples. The two powers, to avoid controversy, sought arbitration, and as Catholics turned to the Pope, a natural and logical step in an age when the universal claims of the papal see were still unchallenged by individuals and governments. After carefully sifting the rival claims, the Pope issued in 1493 a series of papal bulls which established a line of demarcation between the colonial possessions of the two states. The East went to Portugal and the West to Spain. The partition, however, failed to satisfy Portuguese aspirations, and in the subsequent year, the contending parties reached a more satisfactory compromise in the Treaty of Tordesillas, which rectified the papal judgment to permit Portuguese ownership of Brazil. The above quote, the quote I just finished reading, is from Eric Williams' neoclassic work, Capitalism and Slavery, University of North Carolina Press, first published in 1944. Places in focus, says Dr. John Henry Clark, an international situation that started in the latter part of the 15th century that is still alive and with us on the eve of the 21st century. Michael Bradley's book, The Columbus Conspiracy, is a well-researched inquiry into this event that changed the world for all times to come. This event set in motion the Atlantic slave trade that made possible the economic rise of Europe and the expansion of the influence and domination of European people throughout most of the world. Christopher Columbus is the best known of a number of Western thugs and murderers who have been presented to the world as a hero and a discoverer. One thing we can say about Dr. Clark is that he did not bite his words. And he called it as he saw it, and as he saw it, and as those of us who are studying history can see, thugs and murderers is certainly a more appropriate label than hero and discoverer. Continuing reading from part seven, a future examination of his action will prove that he had no regard for the people he encountered on the islands in the Caribbean, and he did not appreciate their initial friendship toward him and his crew. A fact that is often overlooked is that a large number of the crew of the three vessels of Christopher Columbus were criminals, let out of jail to go on this voyage because it was difficult to recruit others because of the apparent danger of such a mission. The following extracts, taken from the Journal of the First Voyage of Christopher Columbus, 1492 to 1493, which is found in Eric Williams' book, Capitalism and Slavery, clearly indicate his attitude towards the indigenous people of the Caribbean islands and the Africans he had previously met. The Portuguese generally referred to the west coast of Africa as Guinea. It also indicates that Christopher Columbus could have been a participant in the early Portuguese slave trade. Entry number 50. The enslavement of the Aboriginal Indians. Journal of the First Voyage of Christopher Columbus, Friday, 12th of October. They should be good servants and intelligent, for I observed that they quickly took in what was said to them. Sunday, 14th of October. These people are very simple as regards the use of arms, as your highnesses will see from the seven that I caused to be taken to bring home and learn our language in return. Unless your highnesses should order them all to be brought to Castile or to be kept as captives on the same island, for with 50 men, they can all be subjugated and made to do what is required of them. Monday, 12th of November. Yesterday, a canoe came alongside the ship with 6 youth in it. 5 came on board, and I ordered them to be detained. They are now here. I afterwards sent to a house on the western side of the river and seized 7 women, old and young, and 3 children. I did this because the men would behave better in Spain if they had women of their own land than without them. Of course, there was absolutely no regard to the fact that these women and these children didn't belong to these men. The following comment is taken from a speech. It's time we rethink our history. By David R. Stidham. At the first celebration of African American culture and history at Stratford High, Nashville, Tennessee, and published in the CALC report in March of 1990. When we begin to rethink our history, we understand why history books were wrong. We were all miseducated. Columbus did not discover America. The historical facts, in December 1492, Columbus was totally lost, wandering around the Caribbean islands, thinking he was in Asia, when he was discovered by the native Arawak Americans who lived in these islands. Actually, it was the Arawak's ancestors who, 50,000 years before Columbus, discovered the Americas when they walked across the land, bridging the Bering Strait. Columbus didn't discover anything. He was so confused and lost, he thought he was an Indian and called the Arawaks Indians. Christopher Columbus was considered a saint by the Europeans who hailed his great so-called discovery. We need to rethink our history. Columbus was no saint. And the Arawaks were not uncivilized savages, like the Africans who came to America before and after Columbus, like the Africans who came to America before and after Columbus. I had to repeat that. These were gentle people with a rich culture who worshiped the one creator. When we begin to rethink our history, we begin to put into historical perspective the true role of Europeans in our 500-year history. The prosperity, the wealth, the good European lifestyles we enjoy today in America began in 1492 and from its instant beginnings. This prosperity grew out of slavery. You see, slavery did not begin with the importation of African people to America. Slavery in America began with Columbus. The first slaves were not Africans, but Native Americans. Columbus wrote in his journals about the inhabitants of Haiti, present-day Haiti. All the inhabitants could be taken away to Castile or made slaves on the island. With 50 men, we could subjugate them in all and make them do whatever we want. In truth, that is exactly what he did. Columbus enslaved the gentle Arawak Haitians, or Haitians, forced them to give up their gold and their land. After all, he had discovered these riches. They were his for the taking. What is also true is Columbus took hundreds of Arawak slaves to Spain, where they were sold or died. They didn't freely go with Columbus to meet the king, as my history books led us to believe. In his quest for gold, Columbus had the hands cut off of any Arawak who did not bring in his or her quota of gold. In a short 40 years, the entire race of people in Haiti, a 500,000 Native Americans, were wiped off the face of the earth by Columbus and the Spaniards that followed him. No, Columbus was no saint. We need to rethink our history. That quote appears in Dr. Clark's Part 7, and he quoted that speech entitled, "It's Time We Rethink Our History," by David R. Stidham at the first celebration of African-American culture and history. One of the things that I personally love about Dr. Clark is that he writes very plainly. He does not, in my experience with in reading his books, he does not mind quoting and giving credit to those who are saying parts of history or giving information about history that are supportive and are clear, and it just makes the reading so much more pleasurable and so much more informative. We have time to read only a few more passages, and we're going to continue in Part 7. In his entry of 15th of January, Christopher Columbus infers that some of the people of Carib, and we're talking about Puerto Rico, are cannibals. This is one of the most persistent myths, coming mainly from Europeans, using it as a rationale to reduce some non-European people to servitude. This charge is often made and rarely proven. Ironically, the charge of cannibalism is more often charged to a people who in their society have more than an adequate supply of non-human meat. Those making the charge generally come from a society that has been historically short of non-human meat. From this deduction, I leave it to the individual reader to arrive at his or her own conclusion. Monday, 18th of February. He pretended to have gone over more ground to mislead the pilots and Marines who pricked off the charts in order that he might remain master of that route to the Indies, as in fact he did, for none of the others kept an accurate reckoning, so that no one but himself could be sure of the route to the Indies. In his entry of the 18th of February, there is a clear indication of deception between Christopher Columbus and his pilots. If he originally set out to go to the East Indies, why did he go to the West Indies? This is why the indigenous people, the Caribs and the Arawaks, are referred to as Indians. This aspect of the Columbus saga begs for investigation over and beyond the Christopher Columbus hero worshippers who have written a library of books about this complex individual who we still do not know. In Chapter 2 of his book, The Columbus Conspiracy, Michael Bradley goes beyond the personality of Christopher Columbus and deals with the possibility that there were previous explorers in the Americas, such as the Carthaginians and the Phoenicians. In this speculation, Michael Bradley is not only telling us more things that we need to know about early exploration, he is also telling us about human curiosity in relationship to exploration. In his chapter, Echoes of Ancient Truth, Michael Bradley alludes to the late development of the nation-state in Europe and the still slower development of a uniform language and culture that Europeans could understand one to the other. Today, this would seem like a contradiction because in most textbooks and in the mass media, the European is presented to the world as though he arrived culturally pure and endowed with a knowledge and a mandate to lead the world. What Michael Bradley has said in this chapter is that Europeans, like all other people in the world, had to endure a long and hard struggle before arriving at a state and a condition that could justify what is being called civilization. We want to thank you so much for listening to a short reading from Dr. John Henrik Clark's book, The African Holocaust, Slavery and the Rise of European Capitalism. We look forward to reading other books with you in the future and hope that you will go and get a copy of the book and share it with your family, beginning with your children. Thank you so much. This is Mama McKinney saying thanks for listening. Thanks, Harambe Radio. Take care.